session of 1-2-0-3-5, rule 3.
Freddie Temple, this is rule 3, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. And now I'm going to ask you about the Hadfield Spears unit. Could you tell me what this was, this unit?
Well, it was a very strange amalgam. There was this lady, this Mrs. Spears, and apparently earlier we never saw her, Mrs. Hadfield, who produced a lot of money. And Mrs. Spears was the wife of General Spears, who, of course, was the major person in getting General de Gaulle out of France. And she then later became Lady Spears. And she wanted to start a hospital unit to work amongst the Free French. And so there was a group of extraordinary, now they seem so old-fashioned, women drivers of the very upper class, whose voices were sort of cut glass, and thought themselves right above everyone else. I mean, silk stockings and tin hats, that program, which they did so atrociously, I thought, from the point of view purely of these women. And I wrote and told them so afterwards, sort of made out that it's already a great lark. No more caviar and champagne for us, but just the bully beef like the boys. And so they were one group who drove the vehicles. Then there were the French doctors who were very dedicated and had come out from France and serving, but some of them, like the colonel in charge, Colonel Vernier, fairly wild characters. Then a marvellous group of nurses, whom the wretched drivers called nannies, although they were fully qualified. Then there were us, the Friends Ambulance Unit, whom the drivers again called the dog's bodies, and we were an extraordinary mixture, as the whole FAU was, of academics, and then the practical people who were good with their hands. And this was very good for us academics, and for me as well, suddenly to be in the position of very much the lower class, because it was much more important to be good with your hands and practical than to know sort of a good deal of ancient Greek history. So some of us learned a bit in time. And then a lovely French, colonial French, African, tirailleurs, the people sort of who did the jobs about carried the stretchers and so a lot of jobs in the hospital. Our group went out as sous officier, so the rank of sergeant. I don't know why we were given that. We ought really to have been given just so. And I was in charge of them, and I still smile a bit now, knowing nothing about sort of army life, really. And we arrived at Glasgow, troops swarming on. We were going out at the same time as a party going to Egypt of our lot, swarming onto this ship, masses of them. And I heard one of the more upper class of the Egypt party turn to his neighbour and say, "If the worst comes to the worst, are you ready to share a cabin?" We found ourselves all down in the hold, on bunks, right down in the depths. And there, again, one realised how human we all are, because Nev Coates, whom I became very friendly with, had the bunk next to me, and he's admitted since the wars when we've met. I always thought him very generous, because most nights he would offer me a piece of chocolate or a sweet. But he learned very quickly that I'd been very strictly brought up by my mother never to eat or take anything after I'd done my teeth. And so he always waited till after I'd done my teeth before he offered this. Well, I marched up the deck, up the gangway, with my group, and to the astonishment of the sergeant at the top, gave him a tremendous salute, not realizing it, and then we were taken down into the hold. And this was a very difficult adjustment, I think, for all of us there, and I found it difficult too, because as being in charge of the unit, I found myself having, on one side, to emerge from the hold, and right there, down there, and join with the officers of the other troops and things every morning in the CO's office to discuss plans and things for the day. He was rather impressed by the friends, because I sort of said straight away, and please, one thing we would like would be a place where we could have our meeting for worship. In the mornings, it need only be quarter of an hour. I realise other things are difficult, and before other things happen. And so he said it must be very early. I forget when it was. And so every day, so on the standing orders for the day was Quaker meeting for worship. So whatever it was, 6:45 a.m. or 7 a.m. And there would be some of us at that, and by no means everyone came. And and so that was a long voyage right round the Cape, of course, there. And again, the humanness of the Quakers came out. I mean, I was a bit startled one night. It got to the point where I suppose I oughtn't have been, but I'd had quite a sheltered bringing up, that in the sergeant's mess where we could be, there would be the usual sort of army jokes of a crude type going on. And I forget which of it was, one of our unit had a good many sort of strange and fairly crude songs, and we got to the point where sort of suddenly in the evening one of the sergeants said, "Let's have another dirty song from the friends," which is not how the friends usually think of themselves. And it was wonderful to get to Durban, and of course there to be greeted by the friends in South Africa, and looked after and taken round, and Pat Barr, hasn't in the end reached great fame, but has done quite well. He was non-Quaker in the unit, and found certainly the Quaker attitude rather vague and wishy-washy and not down to earth enough. And then we reached Egypt, had a few days in a transit camp there, and went up to Beirut and joined the rest of the unit there.
What was the work you knew you were going to do in that area?
Well, that was to be an ambulance unit with the Free French forces, and I think the first group had arrived. The fighting had stopped by then, by the time we arrived, but we're still a fairly leisurely hospital unit up there, and moved into in Damascus as well as in Beirut. Well, it was originally in Damascus and moved back to Beirut. And it was from there that some of them got agreement with the local French authorities that they could take supplies from the hospital and drive out and see if Bedouin tribes needed any medical assistance, and the Free French realized, I think wisely, that if the Bedouin could be kept quiet and happy, in the end more Free French forces could be sent down into the Western Desert. The wonderful artist, I can't remember his name at the moment, but in our unit there, Well, I remember driving through Damascus one day in the evening, and it was getting very dark, and he just missed a camel, which is rather a large thing, I should have thought, that you could have avoided. And I said, Humphrey Waterfield, yes. I said, Humphrey, dear, you know, we just missed that camel. He said, I know, I'm finding it awfully difficult to see you. And so I looked at him and said, well, if you took off those very strong dark glasses, it would help. which he did. He was a great character, of course, to have with us. I mean, when we were in the Western Desert, free day, he went down to Mirza Matru, the harbour there, and started, he was painting all the British ships in the harbour. And two military police appeared, of course, and apprehended him, and said they must take away what he'd painted. And Humphrey replied, "No, not till I've memorised them all." And then all turned out in a marvellous old English way, he said, but it didn't matter, because in the end the officer I was brought in front of had been my faggot eaten. So there's that side of the unit. The other side, of course, was these very good practical people who knew how to deal with cars and other things like this.
How did the two groups get on?
Oh, I think fairly well. We were rather in awe of people who the section that repaired one's ambulance and one's lorry, and because they would have fairly severe things to say when you've done things that were rather stupid. But they were on the whole very kind, and the others were glad to learn. What's his name? Ralph Davies, who's now keen on history from Oxford. I mean, he always was interesting, and people liked hearing him talk. And of course, in our time in Beirut, the American family, the Levitts, became sort of really father and mother to the group, and we could all go up there at any time. And he was a lecturer in the American University in Beirut and taught us no end about Syrian and Lebanese history and the rest there. I was ill for quite a little. I surrendered my... And Raymond Alderson in the first unit was in charge of us all when I arrived at the second group. And I forget, I was in hospital for quite a bit at the beginning, but didn't mind that too much. And Beirut was a lovely place then for the thing to be in. And we enjoyed being with the French. I mean, there was the wonderful moment when de Gaulle came in to inspect everyone, and we were lined up in the front, and there was Paul Roque of enormous height at one place, and Sam Evans, who was very small, and not in the right... not graded at all well. So suddenly, luckily, I mean, because most people were talking French, there rang out across the square the wonderful command, Paul Roque and Sam Evans, change places when no one's looking. And which they duly did. And then in the early part of the next year, We had to go down into the desert, into the Western Desert.
Well, what were you yourself doing in Syria at that time?
I never went into the clinics then. I was just a hospital orderly.
Yes, who were the patients? Who would they have been?
The French army. Colonial French and some of and these wonderful... African French from the Cameroons, as they were in those days. Yes.
How did you get on with them?
They were lovely, cause especially if you learnt a little of their language, they would then giggle and smile tremendously, and then want to say it whenever you met them afterwards. I learnt that Bumma Karee was good morning, and Kiri La Bum was their reply. And so I would sort of see a black face in a bed and say, Bumma Karee, and then Kiri La Bum, and terrific giggles. And one learnt very early on, too, the strange thing that a black skin is much more difficult and tougher to inject than a pale skin. I suppose it's got the resistance, so I buckled quite a few syringe needles to start rather before one learned to be rather firmer into the behind.
This must have been very different work to the sort of life you had been leading before the war. You know, I wonder how you took to it. Because you were doing very menial sort of work,
yes,
weren't you, at times?
Yes.
Yes, how did you take to that? How did you adapt to it?
In Beirut, and from then on, later on, to when with the British Army, one found it in moments difficult, and I must say, I suddenly realised, sort of, when travelling out on the troop ship, gosh, how arrogant I must have been when, sort of, travelling first class out to India and back and looking down on the people in third class and other things like that, to see the way the officers would treat us and sort of and the comfort they had and that sort of thing. But it was all right. One place where I was able, luckily, to put him in his place. I mean, I went on night duty in Tobruk Hospital. There was a patient dying who wanted the chaplain. And so I ran off to find him and was told he was in the officer's mess. And there was no one else in there, so I ran in to him and he was sitting in a chair and said, "Sir," and without looking at me, he said, "You do not enter this mess without being given permission to do so." And so I solemnly went back to the door and said, "Sir, may I come in?" And went out and said, "There is a patient dying in my ward who needs to see you immediately." He did feel rather chastened then. And so it was very good, and I think has been, for a clerical life afterwards, very good to have had this experience. And of course, have been under... in some cases, quite difficult nurses and others. I mean, the Friends Ambulance Unit nurses weren't, because they got to know us as friends. But when we were under the army sisters and nurses in Tobruk Hospital, they were quite severe. And one night when I was visiting the Weymouth, when I was a group leader visiting the Weymouth Hospital, there was a pause in the ward, and whoever's on duty said, "I'll cook. We'd better have some sausages and eggs." And so we cooked ourselves out. And to our astonishment, not even the sister, but the matron appeared, and said, "Do orderlies cook themselves sausages and eggs in the middle of the night?" And it made me realise it's always wrong to ask a rhetorical question. The other one just replied, "It appears so, matron, it appears so." And that way.
Do you think you got away with more because you were COs in the hospitals? You know, regarding, one hears about these dragons of matrons,
yes,
and the consultants and what,
yes,
have you. Do you think, you know, that perhaps because you were so individual and educated, that perhaps you stood up to them more?
I think so, yes. And also, we weren't in the end under their discipline. I think that's true. And for instance, in Tobruk Hospital, where water was very scarce when going round, Hamilton Mills, I'm glad, sort of prompted me right at the beginning when we arrived there and said, "Let's opt for night duty." It's much more fun, and there are far fewer sisters, nurses and sisters about, and then we can sleep a bit in the day and do what we want the rest of the day. Early in the morning, we had to go around washing the patients, and there were some black Cameroons and then some white South Africans, and I remember coming up to wash the white South African and sort of saying, and he's saying, "Not unless you change the water after that, nigger." And so I just picked up the bowl and moved on to the next, and he didn't get washed that morning, and it didn't happen again. Whereas probably someone less individual and less wouldn't have put him in his place like that, I think. And so some of us had quite a time in the Tobruk, working in the Tobruk Hospital. Yes. There.
If I could ask you, while you're still in the Lebanon and Syria, that area, you were now quite experienced, weren't you, with the war situation, having been to Finland and there. Were you sort of suffering any dilemmas about the war, and your attitude? Because I understand, would Stephen Verney have been with you at that stage in the Lebanon?
Yes, he was. Yes, and it wasn't, of course, till later, when he was a year or so later, or 2 years later, on the clinics in Tel Tamar, that he had his change of conscience and mind. No, I don't think I was, from a personal point of view, because I had taken this sort of extreme individualistic pacifist position, that it might be that it had to go down to absolute horror and the end of everything. I mean, that Christ's way was to absorb everything, and that if England was defeated, well, we must absorb that and take that on, you see. I, the moment when I was really shaken, I think, was when the concentration camps were opened just after the war, sort of to realize just what was it that I had not helped in stopping, but it was something that would have to go. Right. That's why I've never been happy with any form of pacifism that's tried to maintain it'll be an easier course, it'll be a more comfortable course, the country won't get this happen to it or that happen to it. I think its only way of really putting it forward to say it will be a far more difficult, far more costly there. And one realizes now that one was... for a young man, unmarried, on no pay, and of course all documents signed and parents told, that there would be no sick pay for any disability or wounding. I mean, so in a sense, disapproved to start with, I'd landed my parents with the thing that they would have to support me the whole of their life, a whole of my life possibly, had I been badly wounded, and gone home. And it made me since have much more of an admiration for the married friends with families who'd taken up this position. Maybe they had more resources behind them. So I don't think... I mean, one was concerned. One want, in a sense, naturally hoped that the Allies England would come through, and that all would be well. But it wasn't worrying me from a pacifist point of view, I think.
Did you get to know the indigenous people of the area when you were in the Lebanon and Syria?
Well, not so much. One did later, of course, in Tel Tamar on the clinics. Possibly not so much, I think, there. Partly because I spent quite a long time ill in the hospital not with anything very much, but they seemed to keep me in. And so, well, it was more getting to know the French and these Cameroons. One tried to talk the Arabic as one learnt it with them there, and of course in the Lebanon a lot of them talked French, but I wouldn't say very much really. And one was with the Levitts, this American family who had other American, there were a lot of rather nice Americans teaching and lecturing in that university.
Yes. Did you go to Tel Tama at all?
Not then. Tel Tama, I think, was quite. There was a later development of the clinics later. Right. Yes. Well, when finally Stephen had been there some time in Tel Tama, and one day. Dr. Shirajan, the Armenian doctor we had, prescribed teaspoons of a certain medicine, and to come back in a week if she wasn't better. And the sheikh brought this wife back, because most of them up there had their four, said she's much worse. So he sort of said, well, we'll increase the dose. Let's have a dessert spoon. They were back the next day, and of course they had wooden cutlery and spoon. Said the teaspoon she could manage, the dessert spoon she can't. I should not have been ill long before that. I don't know. Presumably they'd been sawn up and... yes, it was an adventurous time, and the doctor really was very adventurous. I mean, Stephen will have told you his story about the anaesthetic and how someone almost died under his dropping of the chloroform onto the mask. But I had the job of, because the major operation was this trochasis for trachoma, where you the eyelashes have turned in under the eye, and you cut a slit in the upper eyelid, and then take a sliver of skin from the lower lip and insert that into the eyelid, and it turns all the eyelashes out. Because that's what the rubbing of the eyelashes through the shrinking of the eyelid is what causes the blindness. And so he said suddenly one day, we could get far more of these done, Freddie, if you took on sewing up the lip. And so I said, oh, all right. And the first patient I had was someone who had quite a large moustache. And your lip bleeds quite profusely. And so I sewed away, mopped up to find I'd sewn it into the moustache. So I had to say, the doctor just looked down but didn't say anything. He used to, so I slit it open again and sewed up again, and was rather anxious as we visited him each day in the hospital, and would say sort of, and how is your lip? Oh, quite all right, quite all right. Why did you ask about that? And his lip apparently recovered quite well. Most of the men wouldn't let their wives be in the operating theatre alone with us. They would stand in a corner in their dirty old clothes and things there, so we couldn't have tremendous antiseptic arrangements. And one time I remember the poor wife... it was under local anaesthetic, and she wasn't being hurt, but she just wouldn't keep still. And so finally we had to say to the, could you persuade your wife to keep still? And the persuasion was to come straight forward and give her some hearty slaps. and then back again. And some, of course, were frightened about beds. You would find that when they'd been allocated a bed, they would be sleeping under it rather than on it. And it was always rather attractive. I know Stephen may have told all this sort of thing, but in our little mud houses that we lived in, to look out of a morning and see a cortege of camels coming across the desert and wonder what that was, and then to remember you'd got rather a wealthy sheikh in at the moment, and he was just changing wives. He wanted, because we couldn't provide any cooking, and he, someone had to cook for each of them. And so after a week or so, he felt he'd like a different cook. And so that wife came in, and the other one was sent home before that. Very good thing to live in, really, a little mud house like that, because when Dr. Shurajan's piano arrived, it wouldn't get in the front door, so you just had to dig away a bit of the front door, weed it in, and then put it back again. And you could add another room quite simply by just taking the mud round. And they were very thick, so they were cool in summer and moderately warm in winter.
Because you're getting very near to the sort of Bible land, weren't you?
Yes,
yeah. Yes. Was that attractive to you, do you think, you know, to be near a lot of the biblical sites?
Oh, yes, very, and one liked to try and travel to them. On our way up there, and when we went down for leave, to one tried to get to some of them.